How's that? The meeting will come to order of the telecom group. We don't have a quorum yet, folks, but we are going to start with the testimony. We'll approve the minutes a little bit later on here. And we have some excellent testimony coming up today and get an opportunity to learn more about what's occurring here in the state of Minnesota and different municipalities. For those testifiers are here today, essentially what we're trying to do is bring the committee and those following telecom issues up to speed on what some of the important things going on in the state of Minnesota is, and that it's largely an educational format. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day and coming down here on a Friday morning and sharing with us some of your stories. So we're going to start in with that right away. Looking at the agenda here, we'll start off on this called the Municipal Experience with folks with the Competitive Local Exchange Carriers. Dan Lipschultz, Jeff Oxley, are you here? All right. Go ahead and come on down. If you'd be so good to identify yourself for the record and move forward with your testimony. I know, I think you're probably, everyone has been notified of the time constraints we're working with. We want to get out of here by 9:30 and follow your suggested time allotment as closely as possible. So thanks for coming out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Lipschultz. I'm here with Jeff Oxley. We're actually not here in the context of municipalities. We're here on behalf of Competitive Local Exchange Carriers, called CLEX. So we're representing just another telecom acronym, I guess, in this case, CLEX. I think maybe the most important thing to know at the outset is that 10 years ago, no one in this room had more than one choice for local phone service. No one in the state of Minnesota had more than one choice. It was your incumbent carrier, and for most Minnesotans, that was Quest or US West at the time. Things happened about 11 years ago. Sweeping reforms in state and federal law created conditions that allowed clients like mine, the CLEX, to come into the marketplace and for the first time in Minnesota and elsewhere offer a competitive alternative to the incumbent local phone provider. Now, Mr. Oxley is going to talk in some detail a little more about exactly what we do, what we need to provide service, and the benefits we bring to the state. What I wanted to do was to give you a little bit more historical context, because I think if you understand the historical context of our industry, you'll understand a little bit better what we do, what our message of competition is really all about. And I think there's someone who can do that better than I, and if this works, you'll hear in a minute.
Meanwhile, big news in the telecom industry. Singular is changing its name to AT&T. It is a crushing blow to those of us who have come to love the Singular trademark, whatever the hell that is. As you no doubt remember, Singular was co-owned by Bell South and FBC, which had been Southwestern Bell and Ameritech, which before that had been Illinois Bell, Wisconsin Bell, Michigan Bell, Ohio Bell, and Indiana Bell. All of those used to be AT&T. A couple years ago, Singular bought AT&T Wireless and renamed it Singular, but then SBC bought AT&T and changed its own name to AT&T. Then that new AT&T bought Bell South, changing its name to AT&T, making it only logical to turn Singular into AT&T. And down here, too. In other words, thanks to America's antitrust efforts, the country has gone from this to this. Yes. AT&T is the T-1000 of corporations. No matter how many pieces you break it into, it always comes back together.
I don't know how we follow that. And I think it's a funny message. It's also true, and it illustrates the point. And I think the point it illustrates is competition does not come easily to the telecommunications industry. And I'll take you back to the beginning of the 20th century. I'm going to do this in about a minute and a half or 2 minutes. And I think you'll understand the point. With the invention of the phone company, phone service in the United States started as a monopoly with AT&T for about 30 years. Then, early in the 20th century, a number of competitors, a lot like the clients I represent, entered the market for the first time. And around 1908, those competitive carriers actually served more customers than AT&T, which had a 30-year monopoly. About 3 or 4 years later, those competitive carriers were gone. AT&T was again the only provider of monopoly service for a period of 80 years. Until what happened? The most sweeping and most important antitrust lawsuit in this country's history. And that lawsuit against AT&T resulted in a federal court order that ordered the breakup of AT&T in the early 1980s. That brought competition to the long-distance market. But that left us with monopoly control in the hands of the baby bells, the descendants of AT&T, in local markets, one of which was U.S. West, or Northwestern Bell, which became U.S. West, which became Quest. And in other regions, you had Verizon, and you have what's now AT&T. And so that's the context we're operating in. Now, local competition came in 1996 or 97 as a result of major sweeping telecom reforms by Congress and by legislatures like the Minnesota legislature. And we've been benefiting for the last 10 years from the competition that those laws have brought Minnesota consumers around the country. And I think that's the key message I want to leave with all of you. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Oxley, who will tell you a little bit more about what competitive carriers do in this state, how we provide service, and the benefits we bring.
I'm Jeff Oxley. I'm the general counsel for Echelon Telecom. Echelon is headquartered in Minneapolis. We provide service to small business customers in 9 states. We have about 1,400 employees, over half of them, 860, are employed in Minnesota. We got started in 1996, the year the Telecom Act passed. What our business involves is providing telephone service and internet access and telephone equipment to small businesses. We do that in each and every case by leasing a last mile facility or a loop or the wire that goes to the customer premise from Quest. And each one of the over 6,000 customers that we serve in Minnesota, we serve in that way by getting access to the copper pair that runs from a switch out to a customer premise. That setup is not that different than the setup that we have for electricity or gas in this country. If you think about it, they're all networks. They're all distribution networks. The telephone network distributes calls. The electrical network distributes electricity to every home. The gas network distributes gas to every home. But we don't want just one generator of power. We don't want just one provider of gas. We want multiple generators of electricity, multiple providers of gas, so as to guarantee supply and to guarantee competition, so people have some degree of competitive pressure on their suppliers. It's the same way in the telecom business. Echelon provides dial tone and internet access the same way Quest does. We do it over the same facility that Quest uses. It's uneconomic for us to rebuild the entire telephone network. No business has constructed a network of that magnitude without having a monopoly privilege. The cable companies had a monopoly service territory. The Bell companies had a monopoly service territory. The gas companies, when they built their distribution network, did too, as did the electric companies. It's not feasible to ask a new entrant into the telecom sector to build out a replacement network. And society doesn't need multiple pipes and wires going into every household. It's a waste of our resources as a country. So what the Telecom Act did was say, you new entrants into this business, we know that this is a capital-intensive business. We know that you will never build that network that the monopoly company built previous to this. But because we value competition so much and we value what that competition brings to businesses and consumers, we're going to give you access to that network at fair and reasonable rates. And that's where Echelon came from. Before 1996, if you were a small business and you wanted telecommunications services, you had to take what was being offered because there wasn't anybody else. Today, small businesses say, show me what you got. If I don't like what you got, I'm going elsewhere. And they get a better deal. Each and every one of the customers that we have was already a customer of someone else. They only came to us because we were able to demonstrate our value to them. We go out and seek after that business, and I think that's a huge social benefit for small businesses. So in the telecom arena, when you think about regulation and deregulation issues over the course of this session, I think you want to keep in mind that without regulation of that last mile facility, there wouldn't be competition for a huge slice of Minnesota, the small business community. Many residential customers can substitute to a large extent, perhaps, their wireline service with a cell phone, a wireless service. Businesses can't do that. The wireless phone doesn't provide the same functionality as the wireline phone. It can't distribute calls. It can't hunt from phone to phone. It doesn't reach inside of many buildings. The same way with cable. Cable is an alternative, perhaps, for many residential customers now, but the cable companies haven't built their networks in the areas where businesses are. So for the business, small business community in Minnesota, the only choice they have is between clients of Dan, Echelon, DBS Metrocom, others, and Quest. They don't have a choice for cable. They don't have a choice for wireless. That concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we do have a couple questions. Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either for Mr. Oxley or Mr. Lifshutz, when we deal with CLEX, there's a threshold, the four-line threshold. Would you just tell the committee a little bit about what that number means and how our regulations or alternative forms of regulations move on either side of that?
The four-line demarcation is, the idea is to make a distinction between very small businesses, I guess, and businesses that are a little bit bigger. For Echelon, most of our customers are probably around the 6-line, 7-line place. Once you get above, say, 10 lines, you're going to move probably to what's called a high-capacity line or a T1 line. And that puts you into perhaps what some people term as the enterprise class of customers. So I think the 4 or more line was an effort to try to distinguish between the very, very small business and other businesses. The concern with drawing a line was to say that, well, we really do need to offer the very small business some regulatory protection over price. But we don't need to offer the larger business that. And the regulation was principally directed at Quest, is my sense of where it came from. And the thinking was, well, Quest is still the single provider for many small businesses in Minnesota, not so much in the metro area, but elsewhere in the state. And you wanted to offer some protection. You know, once you give somebody pricing flexibility, under regulation, they can always drop that price down. You know, removing the regulation isn't to let them lower the price. Removing that regulation really allows them to raise it. So when you drew that line at 4, I think you were making a judgment that you still wanted to protect the small business from the threat of monopolistic price increases, but you weren't that worried about somebody who had more than 4 lines. I mean, that was a decision that the legislature made that I would personally have disagreed with, because I still think wherever somebody doesn't have a choice, and they have one provider, they should be facing a price with some ceilings on it. The provider shouldn't be able to raise that price wherever they want to go. But that's where you folks drew the line. Is that responsive, Representative Beard?
Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair and members, I know that when it comes to the CLEC world, especially versus Quest, the four line is a magic number that I believe we as policymakers arrived at before I got here, I thought it would be helpful for you to expound on that a little bit from your perspective for members of this committee in particular. At some point, I'd like to explore a little further about why CLEC seem to only do business with people with 4 lines or more instead of companies with 4 lines or less. For instance, the local flower shop that only has 1 line and maybe a fax line, versus the local print shop that maybe has 7 or 8 lines.
Mr. Chair, may I? I'm sorry, I missed the thrust of your question, Representative Peer.
Sure, Mr. Oxley, move ahead.
Thank you. Echelon serves customers who take 1 line, customers who take 2, and so on. Many, not many, but there are other competitive local exchange carriers who do focus on a larger size customer. And they don't focus on that small customer. That small customer is taking analog line service. The bigger CLECs may focus on customers who only take a T1 level of service, which is the equivalent of 24 business access lines. So, that's the DMARC. But CLECs still pursue customers with 4 or under line. Some of them do it, anyway.
I think, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, Commissioner, I used to practice in front of them, but I just, Representative Beard, I represent a number of CLECs, including Echelon, and two of my CLEC clients, TDS Metricon and McLeod, actually serve residential customers. So they're serving, I think, a broader array of customers than perhaps Echelon, from all the way from a residential customer to a one- or two-line business up to the 10-line business customer. And XO serves primarily substantially larger business customers. So there's a range of customers, but we certainly don't overlook at all. Two of my clients actually serve a lot of the one- and two-line customers.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, and I think we'll move on to our next testifiers from Monticello. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Saylor, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes to your satisfaction?
I certainly have.
Would you wish to move approval?
I do.
Minutes have been moved to be approved. Is any discussion around that? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion approved. From Monticello, we have a couple of testifiers here today. You want to identify yourself for the record and move forward with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing us to be here today. My name is Lynn Fleming. I am a member of the Monticello City Fiber Optics Task Force and also the Industrial Development Committee.
And I am Wayne Mayer, member of the City Council. And thank you for allowing us to be here today. Also, it seems kind of weird to be on this side, especially on the City Council, giving testimony. Normally I'm in chambers listening to testimony, so it seems weird to be on this end of it. So bear with me if I kind of stumble through some things here.
I'm going to just give a short synopsis of how the Monticello Fiber Optics Project and the task force began. We've been at this for about a year and a half or 2 years now. Wayne Mayer here had a specific interest in it, and he came to our Industrial Development Committee and spoke about the possibility of Monticello developing its own fiber optic backbone network in the community citywide. The Industrial Development Committee was supportive of that, and with that we went forward and started to get a group of people to talk to the council, and with their approval they elected to have a fiber optics task force formed to further research the project to see what possibilities and benefits there would be for the community. And the task force has been working diligently researching. As you can imagine, there's a lot of information out there that we needed to absorb, and went back to the council and suggested that we have a feasibility study conducted so that we had more information to further develop the consensus of whether or not we should move forward with this project. So we did that. We had Wyndham come in. They had done a similar project and they spoke to the council. And we developed a vision that we wanted fiber to every home and business in Monticello citywide. That was our vision. And that's how we have been moving forward. And I'll let Wayne Mayer talk more about the details of our project and the vision that Monticello continues to have as we move forward.
It began as an idea of what we could do to separate Monticello and bring economic development into our city as far as our local communities, the surrounding communities of Buffalo, Big Lake, Becker. Sometimes we refer to those as the three B's, but municipalities are always competing with one another. And we are looking for something that would actually bring about a something completely out of the box and bring economic development to our cities. In the past 2 years, the vision has grown and has grown tremendously. In the last 2 years, in fact, the task force is now looking at a state-of-the-art telecommunications network, customer service, really focusing on customer service. Unfortunately, our local provider from Monticello, TDS, just recently closed their doors to any customer walk-ins for throughout the city, which adversely affects that type of customer service or where our people can go. so we really want to, you know, bring that back into the city, bring that back, bring that customer service back into the city. Community involvement, internet technical support could actually include house calls, especially to our senior population. How many times or how many horror stories have you heard where the senior is having problems, they call up their local phone company or their local cable provider, and they try to talk them through on the phone how to troubleshoot their own internal wiring and everything. To me, this seems rather archaic. I mean, let's get back to real some good customer service. This has actually become enveloped in part of our actual customer service program that we're trying to implement throughout our whole fiber backbone philosophy. Services that we can actually bring to the community besides internet, of course, voice, long distance, and cable TV. This would provide Monticelloans another choice in these areas, which is now served by the monopolistic providers that are currently there. Like I say, TDS is our local provider, and we believe that we are probably have the highest rates in the state because there is no competition. So that is another reason for us wanting to go down this path, is to give our people another choice. Video production. The ability to offer our school district their own public broadcast channel, not just the educational channel that the cable TV providers give them, but their own public broadcast channel, so that our residents at home could have actually sit at home, and we have a lot of seniors, watch actual school board proceedings online, live at the time, as well as city council proceedings. And the ability to offer our hospital district the same type of capabilities. Other items that we're looking at are demand load management from the electric company, automatic meter readings, electric or water, home security and home monitoring, especially for our senior population. Home monitoring would be ideal. Can you imagine if grandma or grandchild is like in Denver and wants to make sure that grandma's all right back at home in Monticello, all they got to do is get on the internet and actually have live video feed, actually seeing that grandma is all right, that type of applications. Just total community monitoring for that type of thing. All of these multiple uses of broadband would be near impossible to achieve without a fiber optic backbone. And we believe this future-proof reliability and broadband with the fiber optics is needed to achieve these enterprises. At this point, I guess we can take some questions. Or
I would just like to add another comment that we did meet with the current providers initially when we were developing our vision. We sat down with both of them and asked them if they had any interest in doing what our vision was, to have fiber to every home and business, and we were told that that was not their vision. So I just want everyone to know that we did meet with them, and so because they were not interested in that and we still were, this is why we're moving forward. And that we would start out with probably, you know, anywhere from 10 megabytes up to start out. A lot of these applications Wayne's discussing requires much higher bandwidth than is currently available. And there is wireless out there, but that is limited as well. We would offer up to 100 or up to a gigabyte would be available. In the next couple of years, 100 megabytes will not be uncommon for some of these higher need applications like home security and so forth and the home monitoring. So we're trying to stay ahead of the curve and to be ready for that technology when it's here. We can make use of it now to a limited degree, but the infrastructure needs to get in now. It will only go up in price to build this out later. So we're trying to plan ahead for the future so that larger companies can come, the Medtronics and those type, can take a look at Monticello and at least say, here's an opportunity for economic growth. People are tired of driving to the metro. They want to stay and work in the same community, and we can have a quality of life at home and at work where they can enjoy living in a community that can provide things that they can't get in other communities, that differentiation.
And the best thing about this is that when we went ahead with this feasibility report, the single most criteria was that it would not be taxable to our city of Monticello residents. So this whole program and our feasibility report and our business model is all based on revenue bonds.
I think we have a question.
General obligation bonds.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Hoppe.
I can wait close. I'm finished. Thank you. Okay. You have to tell me when to be quiet or I'll just keep on talking. I'm
That's all right. We got all day.
I think you had a handout, too, that it's good to pass out. Do we have that already passed out?
I don't believe we had a handout specifically, but maybe he's referring to something else, Mr. Chairman.
There's one from Buffalo, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, that's from Wyndham. Okay. Any further information you want to share? Well, thank you so much for coming out and giving this to us. Anything else?
Thank you.
Our next testifiers are the Bison from Buffalo. I'll let you identify yourselves for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Shinnick. I'm the technology director for the City of Buffalo. We're here today because we're interested in communications, and I understand the role that technology plays in filling the need for good communications. From the city's perspective, we're concerned about how communications can do the most good for the public, our citizens. And I'd just like to maybe take a few minutes to explain the history of how Buffalo has gotten to where it is today. The City of Buffalo has long recognized the value of the Internet. We had our website public long before many other cities did. We recognized that the Internet was a good way of doing, of providing communications to the public and provide this 24-hour business operation so that we can reduce call load at the city and also get information to the citizens when they need it, not just restricting them to the 8 to 5 Monday through Friday business day. So high-speed Internet communications, they're also essential, though, for the city's economic development and for our citizens. A little over 10 years ago, the City of Buffalo, members of the community, including the schools, Wright County, and area businesses, we met to form a technology task force. I sat on that committee. We found that there are many different ways that these different organizations could collaborate, work together, maybe even share data. The other part of this is that some of these organizations, we have different facilities located across the city. The city buildings and infrastructure, they're located across the city, and the same is true of the county buildings, which have three different facilities in Buffalo. So we also found that this was true of the schools and other businesses like the banks that may have a main office in one location, but a branch maybe in a grocery store or somewhere else. Other businesses maybe had a similar situation. Well, as a group, we could see the value of running fiber optic to key locations in the city, including the city's industrial park. We invited the local cable and telephone companies to the table to discuss this. However, they had no interest in working on this project. If we're always waiting for someone else to do these things, nothing would ever get done. So the city was in a good position to be able to see the fiber optic project through to completion. We already had right-of-way, and we, at the same time, it just happened to be that we had certain street construction projects that were going on that allowed us the opportunity to bury this fiber in the ground. Additionally, this helped us to establish the communications that we needed between our buildings to be able to set up SCADA systems to monitor our water towers, lift stations, and our wells and our electrical distribution facilities in town. The other thing about it is it allowed our law enforcement agencies to be able to share data back and forth between city and county, which at the time greatly reduced the cost of having to replace the city's or the city police department's record server due to that year 2000 bug that you might remember. If we just consider the savings that saved us of not having to obtain that police record server, being able to share with the county, it saved the city nearly $200,000. The city has had an interest in seeing this project through, and if others would benefit from the fiber optic project and be able to contribute to it either upfront or through ongoing access fees, we'd be able to share the expense. As it turned out, everyone was happy. The schools were happy. They were linked together. Government buildings could communicate. We had better control over our utility infrastructure. The banks, they were now linked point to point. And we were able to provide high-speed Internet access to the businesses in town, in our industrial park, and also to the public library. So, and this was at a time when high-speed Internet was not yet available to the general population. In time, other businesses and residences that didn't lie along our fiber route, they wanted the same services as well. Again, we repeatedly pleaded with the local telephone and cable companies about DSL and high-speed Internet but for these businesses and residences, but again, they firmly stated that Buffalo was not on their radar. In recent times, Buffalo has been a fast-growing community. Many of our residents are commuters. they need the high-speed internet connection to maybe, well, telecommute. They maybe work from home 1 or 2 days a week. We know that more and more residents depend on high-speed internet for education, whether it be some ongoing learning program, college level, or even K-12. Businesses depend on the internet to operate. As a state, you require them to be able to file their taxes electronically now. For the city, this was an economic development issue. We needed to be able to have these services available for businesses and citizens to be able to attract them to Buffalo. The citizens were putting mounting pressure on the city council to do something about this and to get high speed out to Buffalo. It really didn't make sense to run fiber optic into residential neighborhoods. However, we did have fiber to our water towers already, and we could use that to maybe put radios in there and transmit this high-speed internet signal over wireless to businesses and residences in Buffalo so that they could benefit from the work that had already been started. So in November 2001, the city unveiled the Buffalo Wireless Internet Group in order to fill this need. The wireless infrastructure also benefits the city in other ways, too. It allows for remote access and monitoring of our sewer lift stations. The sewer plant is connected by this wireless system, so it allows us to be able to, either from the water plant or the sewer plant, to monitor or control the infrastructure. In another phase of our wireless network, we were able to provide mobile wireless connectivity for the benefit of public safety, police and fire, for our public works department, and also for our utility crews. So as you can see in Buffalo's wireless communication system, it not only benefits the residents and businesses in Buffalo, but it also benefits the city in its ability to provide essential services to the public. Hopefully you received a copy of this information piece that we had distributed. It's about our wireless internet service. It's not a marketing piece, but it just provides some information about what we do and how we do it with regards to our wireless network. It may answer some of the questions that you're already thinking of. Now you might give your attention to Joseph Steffel. He's the utilities director for the City of Buffalo. He's going to talk about the future, policy issues, and we'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Mr. Steffel, you identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Joseph Steffel, and it's with L at the end, S-T-E-F-F-E-L for the record.
Okay.
I'm the utilities director for the City of Buffalo. I've been here through 8 years. I've actually been through this whole change to internet service and wireless networking. And I want to tell you, as far as the operations of the utility, if we are going to maintain staff levels at the current levels without adding people, people are demanding much more out of our personnel as far as services and the quality of services of what they want. They want to know when they have a street light out, they want it fixed, and they want it fixed yesterday. We actually had an occurrence where we have an online service that you can put in a request for a street light out. We had one last year that was fixed within 2 hours from the time that it was entered. And this may not seem like much, but as far as people being able to ask for services, the way they want to have services, it means a lot, because we're in constant contact. We had a transmission outage on the electrical system on Tuesday. The hospital was notified within 5 minutes that we had the outage. We were working on the outage. We weren't sure what the problem was, but we were in touch with our transmission provider. And we get back to them because they're scheduling surgery. And they had to know if they had to cut the surgery schedule for the morning or how they're going to make that work out. Well, within 15 minutes, we got a call back from the transmission supplier what the problem was, how we were going to switch things out. And we were in constant contact using our wireless system and our internet system to let people know what the status was of the outage and that we were working on it. I think that means a ton to these people when they're trying to conduct business, especially if they're dependent upon, as we all are, for electricity. We are the electric provider in Buffalo as well. I should have made that point. But as far as the future goes, that we believe that conservation programs are going to be customer-driven. We believe that customers have to have the right to make a choice about conservation programs. If you're going to turn your air conditioner off for 15 minutes on the hour because you want to save a few dollars and you're concerned about conservation, you ought to be able to do that. You ought to be able to do that from your home rather than having to call through, talk to somebody, and get on the list for somebody to call you back. We have immediate contact with our customers. That's so important. Councilmember Mayer from Monticello brought it up. Customer service to us is number one. We have to change, and we have to be able to provide as much service as possible to our customers. And with that, I'll ask the chair for questions or anybody on the...
Oh, thank you for your testimony. Looking at your information sheet, it looks like your project was funded through revenue bonds. Is that correct?
That's correct. Through loans and revenue bonds, yes.
Okay. And it gives the different cost listings for the type of service you want. What is your sense of satisfaction with the citizens with your speed levels? Do you have any feedback on that?
Mr. Chair, if I may... One of the things that we notice is that we want to be able to cross economic lines as well. And if you take a look at that, we have a service for less than $10 a month for just under 200K. What we really wanted to do is we wanted to be able to have everybody have it available to them. We just didn't want to have it to people that could afford the 1 gigabyte or the high speed. So that was one of the philosophies we tried to do. Is we tried to give it to the entire community. You've seen?
That answers my question. Members, any questions at this time? Well, thank you again for your testimony. Really appreciate you coming out on Friday morning and
thanks
sharing
for
us with this information.
Thanks for
thank you. And from Winona, Judy Bodway, come on up to the testifying desk there. Identify yourself and tell us what's going on in Winona.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, representatives. My name is Judy Bodway, and I'm the Assistant City Manager for Economic Development for the City of Winona. And I also provide the staff services to the Port Authority of Winona, who's been designated officially as the economic development arm for the city. I'm pleased to be here, and my intention is to present a history of telecommunications in Winona. This history has been very long and diverse and has been an important part of the growth and vitality of the Winona community. Telecommunications began in Winona with the need to provide television service. The topography of Winona has prevented television signals from reaching most of the community. Citizens and local government pushed forward a desire to have a television service in Winona, and as a result, the TV Signal Company of Winona began operations in the early 1950s, providing cable service to the citizens. It was the first cable TV company operating in the United States. Cable was only viable at that time in areas where signal strength was an issue. Good reception areas such as the Twin Cities didn't see the need for cable services at that time. In the 1970s, cable became more viable to more areas because it offered better reception quality, more channels, and pay-per-view programming. Cable in Winona is a necessity, not an option. From the inception of cable in Winona, penetration of cable service has always been around 90% plus. Cable is viewed as just another utility that must be provided to the citizens of Winona. And until the late 1990s, Winona was served by only one cable provider. In 1987, Winona was approached by a company called Long Distance USA. This company was located in Hawaii, and they provided long-distance telephone services to businesses there. They were looking for a United States mainland location to grow their service network. The initial discussions with the company included the need for fiber optics to provide high-quality connections for their operations. At the time, Winona was not on any fiber network. A fiber optics line between Chicago and the Twin Cities had recently been constructed, but it was located on the east side of the Mississippi River. The company who constructed the line and owned it was Norlight, was interested in Winona, but was not willing to risk the cost to bring the service to Winona with no firm customer base in mind. The Port Authority at that time struggled long and hard with what was then new technology, fiber optics. Long Distance USA needed the fiber, Norlight had the fiber, and the Port Authority decided that fiber optics was the next new utility needed for the business community in order for them to grow and thrive. What happened then was the Port Authority agreed to provide a $150,000 loan to Norlite. Norlite would then construct a fiber optics line across the Mississippi River and into a building in downtown Winona, providing the first point of presence of fiber in Winona. The loan was very controversial at the time. The $150,000 loan was at no interest and went for 10 years. If it was not repaid in full by the end of the 10 years, then any remaining payments would be forgiven. And the loan repayments would only come from the revenue from users on the system. The only user who had signed on for the service, a local long-distance telephone company who continues today, would not be included in the revenue used for repayment. So when the Port Authority made the loan, there was not one business customer committed to buying service. Long Distance USA, who brought the project originally to the Port Authority, had yet to confirm their Winona operations. The Port Authority took a leap of faith that fiber optics would be the next level of infrastructure needed for the community. In 1989, Sprint, who by then had purchased the Long Distance USA company, opened an operator center in downtown Winona, employing 60 people and using the fiber optic cable. Sprint continues to operate in Winona today with an operator center for major clients and employs over 150 people. Without fiber, this company would absolutely not be in Winona. With virtually no repayments in the first years back to the party for its loan, Norlite did pay off the $150,000 loan in full in 1991, 7 years prior to its expiration. Business was picking up on the fiber optics network, and the Port Authority risk turned out to be a good investment. What happened next was another significant business development for Winona. Local leaders, led by former Senator Bob Turlin, in 1994 formed a new internet provider, eventually called Luminet. This new company gave 40% of the ownership to area educational institutions, including St. Mary's University, Winona State University, and the public and private K-12 school systems. This ownership continues today at the company which is now called HBC. This new company extended the fiber optics line in town from the point of presence in downtown, and it served local government, education, and some limited businesses at the time. This put City Hall on the information network highway with internet access to the world. Not that we knew what that really meant in 1994 at City Hall. The next logical step for Luminet was to provide additional services with the infrastructure they were putting around the community. HBC was formed in 1997 to provide cable, internet, and phone services. And in 1998, Winona had its first competitor providing cable services in the Winona area. HBC and Charter Communications both serve Winona, offering similar services. This cable competition has been watched by local leaders. Benefits with this competitive market have been seen by the customer. Cable rates in Winona have remained virtually unchanged for 6 to 8 years. Today's rates are about 40% less than similar service in La Crosse, Wisconsin. New technology and services being provided is quick to come to Winona as each business wants to provide the best and latest service. With a use rate of over 90% of households and businesses, Winona would be looked at as an old market with no growth potential. This would result in little service improvements without the competition that exists by both cable providers. The city has been a partner with these private companies in the provision of what we call this next utility. Through our franchise agreements, all cable customers are able to watch all council meetings, county board meetings, and school district meetings every month. Locally produced programming is provided to meet the needs of the citizens. The League of Women Voters provides candidate forums every election. The Winona Quality Council provides programs on the activities of our local business community, and local government agendas and meetings are available to the public at all times. Without this partnership, communications with the public would be significantly reduced in Winona. So, in summary, what does all this activity mean to Winona? We have cable service in an area where TV signals don't work. We have a penetration of the marketplace of over 90%. Competitive cable service keeps the cost of services reduced by as much as 40% from other communities. Competitive cable, internet, and phone service means new technology in these services comes to Winona customers early in the process. Winona Health is known as a leader in the medical industry and telemedicine activities. And in fact, they've been invited to speak in London about those telemedicine activities that they have. Winona State University is the only total laptop university in the Minsky system and is one of a limited number nationwide. Our local business community can connect to the world for their business activities. Fastenal would not remain headquartered in Winona if the infrastructure needed for them to operate wasn't available to them. And that infrastructure includes everything from sewer and water, streets and highways, telecommunications, and more. Our businesses such as RTP, Winona Canoe, Hal Leonard, Windcraft, Benchmark, and more all depend on that infrastructure to be there and provided to them. As they grow, Winona grows. Winona's largest challenge continues to be our topography. While the bluffs provide a natural beauty, they are also a huge barrier to telecommunications. While the city is looking towards wireless services, they are difficult to offer in Winona and continue to be. But we are beginning those discussions with potential private providers, and we look forward to seeing what happens and how we can provide wireless service. Winona is always looking to improve. How do we provide the infrastructure that supports our local businesses and citizens? How do we encourage improvements in the infrastructure, specifically the telecommunications? We continue to partner with the business community to find the solutions to these questions, and we look forward to working together with all of them as we continue to grow and thrive. Thank you very much. If you have any questions that aren't technical, I'd be more than willing to take them.
Thank you, Ms. Pogue, for that, for your testimony. Representative Beard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bodway, your description of your cable, the origins of your cable company remind me very much of my small hometown where we got one television station because we were in the mountain valleys. When it was bad weather, we didn't even get that one. But to the point of your fiber, did you say that your fiber goes to every home and business that wants it in the city? Did you overbuild the entire system right on top of your cable system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the fiber is built on top of the cable system. And while it may not go to every home today, it is available to go to practically every home.
Mr. Chair, so if I moved to Winona and wanted fiber, I could get it pulled right to my residence. So there's not nodes with copper going out from the nodes then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are some areas that still have copper nodes, but it's almost impossible not to be able to access fiber. Yes.
Okay. And then just one last clarification. When you say HBC, we're talking about Hiawatha Broadband Company?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
Okay, because we've heard of Hiawatha and they're legendary up
yes.
there. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything further from the members? Thank you very much for your testimony. Very helpful.
Thank you.
From the City of Windham. Gentlemen, looks like you're getting ready to go there.
Yeah, I think we're about ready.
Well, thank you so much for coming up from Windham this morning to share with the committee the information that you have. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson.
Thank
and
you.
You just identify yourself for the record and move forward. That'd be fantastic.
I'm Tom Reardon, Mayor of Windham.
Steve Manasby, City Administrator.
Thank you very much for having us today. Just kind of give you a brief overview of where the City of Windham is at as far as our telecom infrastructure. We have what's called WindhamNet, and when we put that together, over the course of probably about 7 years. Basically, I'll give you a quick overview of Wyndham. We're a population of about 4,500 people. We've held steady in outstate Minnesota rural farming community, where others have dropped off on population. We've remained pretty steady. We do have a high proportion of elderly in our community. We have a couple large employers. Toro has a manufacturing facility there for snowblowers, lawnmowers. And we've also got PM Wyndham, which is livestock processing. And we've got county, it's a county seed, so we've got the county offices, Wyndham School District, a city-owned hospital, and many elderly care facilities in Wyndham as well. Our city layout, I had a pointer with me, but basically the city center is in the center of the city. But it's built out. We've got intersections of Highway 60 and 71 coming through Wyndham and Highway 62. Commercially, we've built out on 60-71. Residentially, we've built out along the Des Moines River. So we're pretty compact, but some of the residential areas have kind of moved out of the city. Oops, I'm wrong. Our telecom history, this was a community-driven project. There was a petition from citizens to get a item on the November ballot in 2000. And the question was whether the city of Wyndham should be authorized to construct, purchase, or proceed to acquire a telephone exchange within its own borders. And Wyndham is served by Qwest. And at the time that we started looking into this, Wyndham did not have any form of high-speed internet, DSL, anything like that. And there weren't any plans in the hopper as far as Qwest was concerned to try to serve a town of that size because they were pushing out towards the metro areas. We do have a major Qwest switching station in Wyndham. So their phone switching for most of the southwest corner of the state is located in Wyndham. One of the things we had talked about originally was whether we would purchase the infrastructure from Qwest if they would sell, and we would go that route and upgrade on our own. Qwest did not want to do that. But the vote, as you can see, passed the 67% majority, said we should look into this, and a telecommunications committee was formed, and I was originally on that committee in 2000 as chair, and we were just basically tasked to investigate our options, see what was out there, evaluate all the different options, and just kind of learn as much as we could about telecom and all the different things that go with it. I should mention also that the city of Wyndham has a very strong utilities background. We own our own electric, and we also have been in the cable business since 84. So at the point we were looking into this, our cable infrastructure, which was coax throughout the city, was starting to show its age a little bit, and to move farther into the future to get high-resolution television, more channels, we needed to look at something there, too. So that tied in with where we were heading. The first thing we did when we started down this path was we set up focus groups and did market research. We brought in community leaders and business people from Toro, from our banks, PM Wyndham, all those different things, sat them down and said, what do you need for telecommunications? What would help your businesses grow? And then we also brought in groups of interested citizens to find out what do they need from telecom, what do they need from phone, what do they need from their cable television. And then we also hired a company called Veteran Communications that did phone interviews, and I think we did about 500 and some interviews on phone, and basically the same questions, and they put all that data together for us, and our overview was that Wyndham Public Utilities has a very good reputation. We serve our customers well, and the community as a whole was confident that the city of Wyndham could move into telecom, make it profitable, and make it work for the city, to be able to handle all the technology. So after that was, we kind of went through, we talked to the community, the citizens, and they said, yeah, I think that's a good idea, we should move on it. Okay, what should we do, the next step? Like I said, we had coax throughout the city. We could just run internet across that coax and maintain our current cable lineup, and we could do that relatively cheaply. That was one of our options. But with that, you're stuck with an old technology as coax is, and it has limited life and limited services. You can only push coax so far as on the speed of the system. Then we also looked at different hybrid systems, a loop of fiber throughout the city connecting into coax or copper. That also has limited bandwidth, and the fiber actually putting that into the ground, or the cost of the fiber physically is not the big cost. It's the labor to put it in the ground, to hook it up to every house, those kind of things. And if you're going to redo a city or you're going to redo some infrastructure, you should put in fiber. The cost to put in coax is almost the same cost, and you just limited your lifespan. Fiber to the home has the longest life, and the technology right now can deliver anything you want to your desktop, to your phone, to your television. And bandwidth right now is basically unlimited on fiber. The fiber in the ground can just stay there and handle any data we push across it. You can upgrade the electronics to make it faster while maintaining the fiber. So it's as future-proof as anything in technology can be, I think. The next thing we started looking at was we put together different construction costs, and we chose fiber to the home as our choice. It is the Cadillac. It's about as good as you can get. It's the highest cost, but it has the highest long-term value. And we had to go through and look at all the different things, the operating costs, the technicians you'd have, the staff, building systems, all those kind of things. And then we looked at what services we would provide as far as channel lineups, packaging of the different services and those kind of things. As far as the construction was concerned, we hired a firm called Finley Engineering, which is based out of Slayton, which is just north of Windham. Very big telecommunications firm in rural outstate Minnesota. They handle a lot of different construction projects. And we put all our fiber underground in conduit, so it's basically a storm-proof system. No overhead lines. And our bids were let, and we encouraged people from the local community to be involved in the construction as much as possible. We are also lucky in Windham. We have Otson Underground, which is a boring company. We bored everything underground. It wasn't trench cut for the most part. Everything was bored under. So we had a pretty good deal there that this company was a low bid, and they were right in Windham. So it helped those crews that travel throughout the upper Midwest, usually they get to stay in Windham for the summer. Construction was completed in 2005. And our first customers were brought online in the third quarter of 2005. Mostly internet and cable television was switched over to the new system at that point as well. Our phone customers came on in probably fourth quarter 2005, and we continue to turn on customers. Our current outlook for the system, we're a couple years into it. Our take rates are looking good. Take rates basically how many people are taking your product and which products are they taking. We are looking at opportunities to become a wholesaler to some of the surrounding communities that have kind of the same problems we had 4 or 5 years ago. They're a small community. They're not getting the service they think they should. And they're looking into doing something on their own. We hope to be able to provide them service. We have a phone switch. We have the video head-end equipment. We have the expertise to handle all that and all the equipment as far as internet, email servers, all those kind of things. That would allow them to kind of share our costs and not have to purchase all that equipment on their own. We did have higher than expected planned startup costs. Our costs when we first bonded this was about $8.4 million, which is pretty high for a community of 4,500 people. And when it was all said and done, it came out to about $11 million. The things that added into that, and I'll get into that in the second page. Our current outlook is we have more income than we thought. We're higher on our take rates than our business plan called for, but we also have more debt. Our next steps are we need to leverage our telecom infrastructure to start driving some economic development. And Wyndham has been without an economic development director for the last year, and we just got someone on board. So we've been kind of stagnant on the economic development front and are pushing forward now with our new director. And our key has always been to have affordable high-tech services. Our bundle, triple play, video, voice, data, all those three services are under $90, which is not an introductory three-month rate. It is what we charge. Whereas most of the items you see with Dish Network and some of those other ones, you don't know what you're going to end up paying in 6 months, but we're keeping it as bare minimum as we can in the cost and just to cover our operating. So take rates, these are a couple months old. We continue to add customers, as I said. As you can see, all the graphs are shooting up, which is good. For the most part, our residential and telephone are our biggest drivers right now. Internet is moving up. We have more internet customers than we thought people in Wyndham had computers at the point when we did the planning. So we're way ahead on that. Our television, we're at 70%. We're at about 70% when we switched over. That was one of the key things. We're already in 70% of the homes with cable television. That helped us get our foot in the door for these other services. In hindsight, some of the things we would have done differently, and this some of these led to our higher-than-expected debt. Our building, we constructed a brand-new building to house all the telephone equipment, a couple vans, and some office space. That was a little over $1 million more than what we expected to put into a facility. We could have used a renovated building. That would have been cheaper, but it also wouldn't have given us as much expansion space or as long-term. So we kind of bit the bullet and put that extra debt. Also, when our business plan showed that we thought maybe about 80% of our customers would want the fiber brought up to their house, the box put on the house, those kind of things. As it turned out, about 99% of the houses wanted those boxes on their house, and we had another 20% increase on the boxes, the conduit, the fiber, the labor during that build-out phase. That's a good thing because now we're up to more houses than we can easily turn on service. It was a larger fiscal outlay than we had intended originally.
It was about 500 housing units, and the average cost to bring that fiber and the box and the unit to that was about $2,100 per house. So that added another $1 million onto our cost.
And then our billing system, we really worked hard to get a good billing system that would work well, that we'd get one bill for sewer, water, electric, telecom, everything on one bill that the customer could pay that way. We do have one bill. The billing system has cost us more than we thought up front, and it doesn't do everything we want. We're investigating options as far as either looking at a different billing system or possibly contracting that out. So in hindsight, those are the things we needed to look at. I'm going to turn it over to Steve here. And once we're done, if you have any questions, they could be somewhat technical. I'm relatively savvy on some of that stuff. Any financial type things, Steve will answer. But Steve's going to go through kind of where we see the state's role and what you could do to help us or smaller communities like us to move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor, and go ahead, identify yourself once again for the record.
Steve Nasby, City Administrator. Mr. Chair, I believe there was a handout
concerning this topic. When I was asked to make a presentation, we were given some direction on what might be some things the state may be able to do to help facilitate this. And I kind of broke it into three pieces: regulatory, promotion of telecom, and support, financial support. I guess I'll just touch briefly on these things as you have them on the handouts. Regulatory, looking at, there have been efforts made, I don't know, in Minnesota. I recently moved up here from Iowa, but I know in the Iowa legislature last year there were several bills brought forth by private utility companies that would basically prohibit municipals from entering telecommunications. That is one thing that I think that if that legislation were brought forth, that we would ask that that be opposed. The experience does exist in Minnesota. As the mayor referred to, we've been in the cable TV business for over 20 years. There's been a number of other communities that have cable TV. We've got Municipal Electric. So we've got a very good history, a very good experience. The public is involved in our process. It wasn't a private sector decision, we're going to serve this block or this business. It was a community effort, and that was important. And as Tom pointed out, the referendum passed by 67% of the vote, so there was broad community support. And I think in something like this, that is, you know, very much needed, is that backing of the community. And again, as the mayor indicated, there's a lot of depth that the community took on. There's some risk, but we're looking at, you know, positioning ourselves for the future. And then as a municipal provider, as Tom referred to, we're in 99% of the buildings or commercial, residential in the community. We serve everybody. We didn't cherry pick customers and the ones. We've got probably 500 or 600 housing units that do not take any of our telecom service, but we've got the fiber to those premises so that in the future that they could be served. So I think that's important for as an educational and just as a community that we had all of those things in. One of the other regulatory items is E911, and this is something our telecommunication manager brought up, is as a phone company, there's a lot of regulatory process with the E911 system, and there's, I guess, the way the fees structure is set up, it's really dependent on the telephone company to be heavily involved in that system. So you wanted me to mention that that would be an area to look at. Another idea that we had for maybe a state's role regulatorily is to look at the building codes. If we're looking out into the future for the state of Minnesota, telecommunications, high-speed data, voice, video, it's going to be very important to have fiber, or at least have a way to deliver fiber to the home. And if we're putting in, you know, new urban infrastructure, putting in a water line, sewer line, it does not cost much to put an empty conduit in the same trench where you can pull fiber through. So looking at the possibilities of bringing those things in the urban environment, it's going to be as basically the same type of infrastructure as we have, water, sewer, electric. It's just that important. So that's one area you could look at. And then also there could be standards for wiring in buildings, or at least having the ability to wire buildings for telecommunications. In promotion of telecom, encouraging regional collaboration, I think, is very important. As the mayor pointed out, the city of Windham has invested quite heavily in this system, but we have the ability to act as a wholesale provider, and we have been working with a couple of other communities in providing service to them. So if some of these smaller communities looked at building facility of their own, I think there's some economies of scale where we could sell them bandwidth and then deliver it on their system. So I think that's one area that could really be beneficial to the development of rural Minnesota, but also the development of some of these systems in hub communities. And then it will also be a source of revenue for those hub communities, which will help make some of these telecommunications expenses or debt more palatable. Marketing Minnesota's technology state. We were known as the education state. We've got a lot of high technology. That doesn't really wrinkle out into the rural areas. When your DED looks at, or businesses look at Minnesota, where's the technology? Well, it's inside 494 and it doesn't go outside. I guess we'd like a little more emphasis on, there are some places in rural Minnesota. The lady from Winona had some very good points of businesses they attracted. I think there's things like that we can do in rural Minnesota. And then DED, obviously, could help focusing on business attraction expansion to smart cities, targeting software, financial, medical, and graphics types industries, ones that are high data users. Those are also typically very good paying jobs, so I think that's a win-win for the state and the communities. And then lastly, financial support. I know that, you know, the legislature is always being asked for money for this and that, but I think some of the things that might encourage more communities to get into it is connecting, maybe some funding for connecting low-income areas. Typically, these are underserved because of the potential for adding more customers or gaining those high revenues isn't there. They just don't get served. And it's that last mile of fiber, that last mile of cable that costs the most. And so especially in a rural area, you know, you may be putting up a mile of fiber but only hooking up a few customers. It doesn't make sense financially. So there may be an incentive there. Maybe DED or the state could look at funding smart buildings, buildings that are completely wired technology, ready to go for a business just to drop in. Maybe a little incentive there. If there's any incentive for upgrades in government buildings, where better to demonstrate the technology than in some of the government buildings where people can come in and use it and come in and see it. So that might be one other area, because I know a lot of the city halls in rural Minnesota are fairly dated, and bringing new technology in would be a challenge. Maybe technology grants for small businesses, getting, you know, the mom and pop stores like we have in Wyndham, get them to get a server or to build a website. It's just not something they're familiar with or something that they're ready to quite take a leap on. The city of Wyndham worked with the Blanded Foundation, and part of one of our projects that we did with Blanden was to build websites for 15 local organizations and get them on as, again, more of a demonstration of technology and what can be done with it. And so I think there's some more that could be done there. And then as far as just building the system out, I think the mayor referred to that we spent about $11 million. There might be a possibility for sales tax forgiveness or something in construction materials for that would help a community, again, with that financial side of things. So.
Very good.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for that. It's very helpful to have not only your overview, but also some of your suggestions on what the state can do. That helps a lot. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. We have a couple minutes left for this presentation and a couple questions. So Representative Beard first, I think.
If I may, tell me about your speed. We saw the Wi-Fi at Buffalo is running about 592K is their gold package. About what are you guys delivering to the end user, the average residential home?
Our basic low-end package is
about
Meg and a half down, meg and a half up. Is our low.
Okay.
We've got what's called the gamer's package, which is for your teenage kids, or for, you know, any major business too could use that. But that's at three? No, that's at five. We can actually push out
100
out to a house. The problem with 100 is you've got this house out there, you're pushing 100 to, you got to have 100 out to the internet as well. That chunk from Wyndham to the internet can get spendy if you're trying to buy 100 meg worth of bandwidth out. So we very closely monitor how much is coming through every house and fit our pipe to that size going out to the internet. Wyndham has been lucky in the sense that in Wyndham we have a presence of Envoy, Quest, a whole bunch of different telecommunication providers have a hut out near our high school that we can get up from there. We can purchase service out to the internet. So we're relatively lucky that we have that connection out to the rest of the world. But right now, our highest package to a house is 5 meg. To businesses, we can structure that however they need to.
That's it. That's going to be a follow-up
question, and I'll let some others ask some. You mentioned that you put the fiber right to everyone's house, so you're paying for the last 100 yards as a public service. And the reason I'm asking is, in most utilities I'm familiar with, the gas, electric, sewer, water, whatever, they put the they use the public right-of-way and have a stub, and then the homeowner or the property owner is usually responsible for pulling the last 80 feet in my case, or if you're the neighbor down the street, the last mile and a half down the lane. That's the homeowner's responsibility. Did you say you pulled the fiber right to the house?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, we did do that. That was part of our plan up front, was because we were already the cable provider. We had cable going to their house already, and they had paid to get that to their house. Our fiber replaced that cable. Our coax is all gone now. So that's part of that, that we just had to continue delivering the service we already had to their house. We also put it there because we knew it would be easier to get customers on if they didn't have to pay that fee to get a board in and all those kind of things. We'd have flip the switch, you're on Wyndham Net. So that it was both because we didn't want to charge them twice for the same install and because we wanted more customers.
Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for either one of the testifiers, I guess my first question would be, do you see a potential for conflict of interest between regulating some of your competitors?
In which, more specific place?
Well, Mr. Chair, to the testifiers, if you're providing telephone services and there's a private company that's providing telephone services and you're a local government that can regulate them and also compete with them, I think I see a potential there for some conflict of interest.
I don't believe that we have any regulation with the local telephone provider or any oversight. We both report through. We're a CLEC, and we go through the Public Utilities Commission to set rates. And
another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the cash flow like? Is this making money yet or ahead of projections? If not, when do you expect it to be?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, the initial business plan showed the system to be in the red for about the first 5 years. Our experience so far, we've been turned up about a year, I would say is fully operational. We are slightly behind in our revenue. We, as the mayor referred to, we took on additional debt, and part of that additional debt was not counted for in that business plan. I think in the next fiscal year, which is our calendar year, the telecom, we're looking to, I think our income is projected to be about $1.35 million, and our debt is, with interest payments and those things, overhead, is about $1.8 million. We're about $500,000 in the red for projected for next year. If our take rates continue the way they have and we make some rate adjustments as programming costs go up, we're looking at about maybe 6 years before it breaks even and is then into the black and we start making money on this system.
Until you start talking about technology.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm done. All right, well, we're running out of time here, so we need to get the next folks up to give their message. Thank you so much for coming down and sharing your story and providing some information to review. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I should also mention, too, we do have our performas, our business plan, all our market research and those kind of things. I could put those on a CD and get them to you people if you'd want to. We want to look at any of those.
That's a bad sign.
That is not a good sign.
It's my driver if he had it in the head. I don't know.
Actually, Mayor, I would appreciate if you could get that to me. That would be fantastic.
Certainly, I could do that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
And our contact information is in the handout as well. So,
thank you once more.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
All right. St. Louis Park. All right. Thank you for your patience. Our last guest for the day is from St. Louis Park, Paul
Krolovec.
Identify yourself for the record, sir, and proceed.
Thank you. I'm actually the president of a company called Umplex Cities. I am the management partner for the City of St. Louis Parks project. We have a private-public partnership with the City of St. Louis Parks creating park Wi-Fi. I'd like to thank Clint Pyers. Clint Pyers is the CIO from St. Louis Park, and he was unable to attend today, but many of his comments I've tried to incorporate into this presentation. What I'd like to do is talk about how the decision was made, some of the technologies that was considered, some of the challenges we've encountered so far with this project, some of the things that the state could do, and some of the things that we'd like the state to avoid. To start, when the decision was made, you have to start with what the objective was. And the objective was to provide ubiquitous coverage, or basically provide a wireless internet coverage through the entire city, and to provide it to the maximum number of subscribers, which would be potentially contrary to what a business decision would be to maximize the profit and provide services at the maximum profit level. So if you start with that objective, the analysis was done, an extensive amount of evaluation was done. We solicited feedback from businesses, from citizens, from government employees, and service providers to basically get an idea of what was required. One of the things that came out very strongly was that there was only, for 65% of the residents, there was only one broadband alternative in the city. The one of the other factors that was taken into consider the decision was that the willingness of the city to basically take economic development funds, basically to fund this thing, because their desire was they wanted to be in control of the system to make sure that we were maximizing the residential acceptance. And so, therefore, they wanted to control the infrastructure and then to outsource the operations, which they've done to Unplugged Cities. They also wanted to look at the ability to basically take this technology and be able to use it for other purposes. So one of the part of the evaluation was how could we use it, whether currently or in the future, for public safety as well as public works, and to promote that image of being basically a wireless community. The technologies that were considered was fiber, a point-to-point or multi-point wireless system, use of Wi-Fi, or just to have just a 4.9 wireless for public safety. And as a matter of fact, if you look at what has happened in the decision, we're actually going to be using all of these components. The amount of fiber that will be expanded, there'll be almost doubling the amount of fiber that's in the city for use by the city, as well as the ability to basically use it for potentially a residential model in the future. The point to multipoint, which is very similar to the Buffalo model, will be used for backhaul. So what we will basically be doing is taking the traffic from the radios on the streets and be taking and backhauling that to the water towers by a point to multipoint system. And then obviously what we'll be doing is employing Wi-Fi radios throughout the city. At this point in time, it was decided that because they wanted the model to be basically funded by the residents and to basically have the payback from the residents, a 4.9 system, while available, has not been put in at this point in time. Some of the challenges they had when we looked at the city and the capability of doing this was constituent acceptance. Like I said, a lot of surveying was done. And the acceptance was very high. There was a feel for a need for another alternative broadband carrier that could provide economical service. One of the factors that was important was, would this technology justify based upon the potential subscriber base? You find if you're going to put a ubiquitous Wi-Fi mesh type system in, that you really need somewhere between 1,200 to 1,500 residents per square mile to have it be effective without needing to basically have it subsidized. Now, some cities, there's lots of cities that potentially will make that decision to do this elsewhere and subsidize it, but for the city of St. Louis Park, the decision was to try and make this model pay for itself by residential only. Another factor that was that we discovered when we did the pilot project, which started in the spring of last year and has been ongoing since, is the availability of power. You need electricity. If you use only light poles, there's only so many throughout the city. Some cities have their own utility and are capable of basically regulating that in light of the fact that we were using the NSP poles. the need for, and the fact that they actually have wireless services using for their own system. We were limited on the number of poles that we could use, and would have required us to basically put additional radios out more than we desired to. So we, the decision has been made to use actually a solar-powered backup or basically solar-powered system, so we're able to use additional poles that are out, ready out. Plus, it's much more economical to drop a pole into a specific spot to make it work. Another factor that is of a concern is when you're pulling fiber, you can't pull fiber all year long, so you do have a construction season similar to road construction. And so, therefore, the timing on this as far as trying to get it out to the residents is was restricted. It'll be a little bit later than we planned. We were hoping to have the entire system built out by the March-April period of time. It now appears it would be closer to the June-July period of time. With Wi-Fi, there's two big factors that affect it, which is topography, elevation, as well as tree cover. St. Louis Park is extremely tree covered. If you take a look at it from the air, it looks like a tree canopy. You can't even hardly see the houses. And this required about 40% more equipment to be put into the space than would be required if you didn't have nearly as many trees. The other piece that was taken into consideration was trying to find equipment that had the capability and flexibility that we wanted, which meant that you wanted to basically have it so they could be upgraded. The package that they've been chosen has a modular type situation, so our components to it, so that you can actually add additional radios. So if they want to put the 4.9 system in, it won't be a complete overhaul. And the ability to upgrade to WiMAX also has that capability within the system. The other piece that the city decided was they didn't want to be an ISP. They felt that what they wanted to do was control the process. They wanted to control the pricing, but decided to contract out to Los Unplugged Cities to provide those services for them. So we're basically going to be providing all of the sales and marketing, the recruitment, the help desk, the billing, the operations of all of the equipment. If you ask me, and if you ask us what should be the things that the state could do to further technology advancement, we believe nothing would be the best thing you could do. Basically, we believe that it's a local decision. It needs to go through an analysis, and every state and city is going to have different factors that they need to consider. Whether the willingness exists to fund this or not, and that decision should be made by themselves. If you want to find something that you could do, funding of experimentation in the high-speed broadband, there's some technologies out there that would be very interestingly could be used in the more of the rural areas that not only could carry technology further from a distance standpoint, but also speeds. There's some capabilities of wireless capabilities that are coming on now that have the capability of delivering 20 to up as much as 100 megabytes to every potential resident. Again, if there's anything you could avoid, it's don't regulate this. Leave it alone. The cities can make a good decision by themselves. I'll take any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, do we have some questions? We don't appear to have any questions at this time.
All right.
Thank Anything you. Else you want to add?
No, not at all.
All right. Well, thank you for your testimony, for bringing this information to us. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
Well, members, the end has come to another meeting of the Telecom Committee. Next week, for your information, we're meeting in room 200. We're actually going to have our first bill, so be ready to go on that. And we're going to try to do a new process for looking at this bill. That's why we're going to be in room 200 and try to get, I don't know how you'd explain it, some email feedback from folks who hopefully might be observing what we're doing on the internet or television and ask some questions as we move forward. Representative Beard?
Mr. Chair, just a closing thought. This gentleman who just presented asked for any questions. actually, I have about a list of probably 100 we could ask.
Right.
He touched on one of my favorite bromides, don't just do something, stand there, which oftentimes is the best thing we can do as state regulators. However, in this case, I'm very interested in the formation of private capital and their ability to compete. And just so the members of the committee know, just because there's an absence of questions at the moment doesn't mean that we're done talking about this issue.
That's correct.
I think that at some point, if the chair can find the time and you have the willingness for it, I think a very useful exercise would be a philosophical discussion about a government entities competing in the marketplace where private capital is quite willing and able to step up, we think. Now, I understand there may be extenuating circumstances. I think of the city of Windham, for instance. Maybe things are different down there than they are in Shakopee, where my cable commission, or the cable commission that represents our town, just took a pass on Wi-Fi, or a city-owned facility, versus Scott and Dakota County, where they just decided to take the plunge to actually pull fiber to tie all the government entities together. Perhaps having several different perspectives aired on this issue would be helpful for all of us, because in some cases, not doing something and just standing there may be in the best interest of the citizens. In other cases, we may actually have some private enterprise we need to protect from the encroachment of city power, which we know can be quite a bit stronger than marketplace forces sometimes. So I just a comment that just the absence of questions shouldn't be misconstrued.
Right. Well, thank you for that. That's great information. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Anybody else want to make any comments before we close for today? Well, thank you, everyone. The meeting is adjourned.